Richard Belzer made his reputation as an abrasive comic. Robin Williams once described him as the Marquis de Sade as a game show host. Now Belzer's stand-up act is laced with political humor, parodies of rock stars, and autobiographical stories. Belzer got his first big break acting in the video and film versions of The Groove Tube. In the early days of Saturday Night Live, he warmed up the audience before the broadcast started. Then he graduated to guest star shots. After his regular appearances on the late-night TV show Thick of the Night, he got his own cable show, Hot Properties. He's done several cable comedy specials, and he'll be starring in two forthcoming movies. Richard Belzer is in New York to laugh in the new year in a show at the Felt Forum. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York before his New Year's Eve show, and I asked him what it's like to deal with the crazy audiences on New Year's Eve.
Well, anytime you get any people drinking in an audience, being a nightclub comic, I have a lot of experience with that, they're going to be a little tilted. New Year's Eve exaggerates that quotient, so I expect that they'll be a little vociferous. But my rule is I'm never on or rarely on stage at midnight. I try to go on as early in the evening as possible before people are totally whacked out of their skulls and don't know what planet they're on. So it depends on what time you go on New Year's Eve.
You must be used to handling absolutely everything and anything. For 5 years in the mid-70s, you were the MC at Catch a Rising Star, comedy club. So you must have learned how to handle everything, including the craziest hecklers.
Yeah, well, when I first started, I didn't talk to the audience at all. I just introduced the acts. And then as time went on, I realized that I had to address the audience and asking people where they're from, what they're wearing, about who they're with. And it just kind of evolves, and sometimes you discover, sometimes I initiate it, and sometimes there are hecklers. So there are all different kinds of hecklers. Some people are very innocent, they just want to be a part of the show, and they think they're helping the comedian. Some people are mean-spirited drunks who want to disrupt the show. Some people are disruptive without even knowing it. I mean, it's just everything you could possibly imagine. Like relatives, I guess. It's a good analogy.
You said sometimes you would initiate it. How so?
Well, if I come out on stage, I don't usually like to start with prepared remarks. I usually just come out and say hello to the audience. And then if I see someone who looks interesting in the front row, a couple or a person, I'll ask them where they're from, and then I'll ask them what they do, and then I'll ask them all different kinds of questions to elicit responses, and then ad lib and improvise off the information they give me.
You've seen a lot of bad comics perform.
Yes.
What are some of the mistakes you've seen them make that you've learned from?
Well, a lot of them make the mistake that I made when I first started, and that's to rush your material when you're not getting a laugh, to speed it up. And that's the death knell. That's the worst thing you can do, is to speed up the material. What I used to do, my fatal flaw, was I would get mad at the audience for not laughing, not thinking it was me. So I would get hostile towards the audience for not laughing, and it just kind of built into this trap that I would put myself in and had to kind of verbally dance my way out of. But I soon realized that the thing to do is to take your time and not rush the material. I'd say that's the number one rule.
When you were angry at the audience for not laughing, what would you say to them?
I can't say it on the radio.
That bad.
But that period in my career didn't last too long, though. That was just like a few weeks when I first started. I realized what I was doing, because I would tape my act. A big thing with comedians when I started, I hope they're doing it now, is recording your act every night, and then you could listen back to it and see where you rushed and see where you got the laughs and see what works and what doesn't, and it's invaluable.
Richard, can I ask you to move about an inch back from the microphone?
Okay.
Great, thanks a lot. The peas are just bobbing a little bit.
Sorry. Oh, Well, I didn't realize it, but I thought the mic was in back of me. Mommy, could you move that mic for me? Thank you.
You've done a lot of television, and I'm going to ask you about what was, I'm sure, the most dramatic moment for you, which is when you were hosting Hot Properties and your guests were Hulk Hogan and Mr. T from WrestleMania.
The fascist twins.
Yeah. Well, you were nearly killed on that program.
I was. I'm glad you find that humorous. But no, it was one of the most bizarre events ever, because I had them on the show. Someone on my staff said, we can get Mr. T and Hulk Hogan on the show. And I said, yeah, sure, right, great, because I'm not really a big wrestling fan. I was when I was a kid, when it was Antonio Rocca and Ricky Starr and the Graham Brothers. I don't know if you remember those people.
And Haystacks Calhoun.
Yeah, exactly. So then it was more theatrical and taken for what it was. These guys, for some reason, I think it's steroids, hardened the arteries of the brain, and fear of not being masculine, because they pump themselves up, they become everything that they think they can do to become a man, and actually they're antithetical to men because they have to go around beating people up to prove they're men. So on my show, I met Hulk Hogan before the show. He was very nice to me. And during the show, for some reason, he got real crazy, and I asked him to demonstrate something on me. Now, I had had Mark Breland, who's an Olympic boxer, on my show. We did a demonstration. He didn't actually punch me. I did a lot of different things on the show where no one ever actually physically attacked me. So that was the last thing in my mind. And for some reason, he took upon himself to knock me out in his arm. He kind of crushed my head until I couldn't breathe.
A stranglehold?
Yeah, and then it's called a front chin lock. And then he dropped me to the floor while I was unconscious. And I hit the back of my head on the floor and woke up in a few seconds, and jumped to my feet and went to a commercial. And then I realized that there was Niagara Falls was pouring out of the back of my head. And then I went to the hospital and I ate stitches. So now I'm suing him for $5 million.
When you were unconscious and you came to for a few seconds, did you really? I never saw this program. I never saw a tape of that particular show.
Right.
But when you came to, did you actually say, "We'll be back after this"?
Yes, I did. And my doctor was amazed because I was in shock at the time. And I just sprang to my... first of all, when I was unconscious, I had a dream. And I was only out for about eight or 10 seconds. I had a dream. I was dreaming that I was late for something, like, you know, the show or something. And little did I know, I was dying on the floor of the studio. So I sprung to my feet and I said, "We'll be back after you know what," because I never say the word commercial. I always say, "We'll be back after this," or "message." Or... So I had the temerity to do that. I guess show business was in my blood, only I didn't know it was going to be all over my jacket and the back of my head.
Did you think you were dying?
Well, he knocked me out so fast. It was very painful. He started squeezing my head, and I tried to signal him, but I couldn't even lift my arms. And then my brain said, "Check, please," because there was no oxygen going to my brain, so my brain wanted out. So my brain turned off, as brains do when you're being strangled.
I'm probably cynical enough so that if I was watching it at home, I would have thought, "Oh, I bet that was staged."
Well, the amazing thing is, one of the reasons I'm suing is because a lot of people thought it was staged. Many people could see that it was real. But a lot of people thought it was fake, because wrestling, by definition, is fake. But I can assure you it was real, and I have the scar to prove it and the lawsuit to prove it. And it was just a grotesque anomaly in show business.
Did it affect your career at all?
I'm not allowed to talk about that.
I see. Okay. Right. Okay. Well, let me ask you about your life and how you got into comedy. Now, I know you grew up in a housing project.
Yes.
And I've read that you didn't have a lot of money when you were growing up.
No.
And I assume that you were one of the funny kids in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Was that a kind of protective shield for you, being funny? Did that mean that you weren't going to be picked on by the toughest kids around?
Well, it's interesting. My wit has saved me more than once. And I found when I was a kid that the tough guys, a lot of the tough guys in the school, liked my wit. So I would hang around with some tough guys, and we would come across some other people, and I would, like, put them down, and they'd go to beat me up, and my friends would beat them up. So I never really had to get in any fights, really, because I would, like, kind of instigate a fight, and then Vinny or Rocco or Vito would do the rest.
Instigate through verbal abuse?
I sound like a little fascist, don't I?
Yes, you do.
But that's when I was a little, you know, I was young. It was 30 years ago. I was a young, skinny kid.
Now, you've said in one of your routines that when you were young, your mother used to beat you, and that you would try to tell her jokes to get her to stop.
Right, right. Well, she was the toughest audience I ever had.
Yeah.
And my kitchen was the toughest room I ever worked.
Well, how true is that, though?
Actually, it's quite literally true. It didn't work as much as legend has it. But I when I was a kid, I had a crew cut, or a zip, what they called then, very short hair, and I looked just like Jerry Lewis. And I used to do a Jerry Lewis impression. And sometimes my mother would get mad at me, and I'd do my Jerry Lewis shtick, and she'd laugh and forget to hit me. But I'd say that worked maybe 2 times out of 20. So she usually wound up hitting me anyway. So the material wasn't that strong.
You know, one of the many old cliches is that humor comes from pain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds like it's actually kind of true in your life.
Literally and figuratively. But see, I subscribe to that theory to a point. I don't think that you can relegate a facility to be funny or any talent to a specific psychological situation. I think there has to be talent that is naturally intrinsic to the person. And then if there's a psychological situation that makes it come out. I mean, I don't think that every kid that was hit grew up to be a great boxer or a great,
great comedian.
But I think there has to be something there, and the two work together.
I know exactly what you mean. Now, you've also said in your routines that you were thrown out of every school that you went to. Does that include college? Were you thrown
out of college? Yes, I was thrown out of college. It was funny because I one of the reasons I was thrown out is because I led a demonstration in 1964, before there were Vietnam War demonstrations. This was like the wimpiest demonstration. We wanted to have women be able to visit the boys' dorms, or the boys visit the women's dorms, I forget. So I got all the guys in my dorm to, like, march over to the women's campus, you know, like clapping our hands, you know. And the security guard, his name was Joe, and we all knew him, he came over to the crowd, the mob, and he said, "All right, guys, come on, let's go, break it up." And we said, "Okay, Joe." And that was the demonstration. There was no bomb throwing. There was no Mario Savio. There was no...
For this, you got thrown out of college?
Well, that was that was on my record that, you know, I led a demonstration. I broke curfew. I, you know, had liquor in the dorm. You know, well, how bad can you be in 1964?
Right, right. Now, then you went into the Army.
Yes, and I was thrown out of the Army, too. Well, I was actually discharged under honorable conditions for being too funny to carry a gun. So wait a minute, this guy's too funny. He's too funny, which is almost true. Actually, I got out of the Army by feigning mental illness, if you will. I pretended that I was suicidal, and I staged this whole thing where I said I got beat up and my back was hurting, and they found out I was faking, and they sent me to the Jewish chaplain in the Army. I didn't know there were Jewish chaplains. I thought Pat O'Brien was the... I didn't know Jews joined the Army. I didn't know Jews were, let alone chaplains. And I went to this rabbi, and I said, "Rabbi," because my sergeant said that you know, you got to go see your chaplain, Belzer, because you need help. So I went to the chaplain. I said, "Chaplain, with all due respect, I think I need to see a psychiatrist." And he said, "You know, Freud was a Jew. And the reason he became a psychiatrist was to discover his Jewishness. You don't need a psychiatrist. You need to discover why you're a Jew." And he lectured me on kosher food and choirs, and how I could sing to the Army Jewish choir and eat kosher food. And I said, "Really, Rabbi, I need to see a psychiatrist." He said, "You have to discuss. Do you have a girlfriend?" I said, "No." He said, "Did you ever have?" I said, "Yeah." "Was she Jewish?" "Good." Like, everything was revolved around Judaism, which was the farthest thing from my mind. And I just wanted to get out of the Army. Finally, I was allowed to go to the psychiatrist. And I, having had a little college, I knew every freshman psychology phobia. So I said that I wet the bed, I was suicidal, I hated my mother, I was afraid of women. I just did every cliche in psychology, and I got out.
That's amazing.
I hope no one's listening.
That's probably
from
one
the Pentagon.
One of your most convincing performances.
Yeah, and I never do this on stage. Maybe I should tell them my Army story on stage.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. There's a lot more. I mean, it's a 40-minute story. I'm really brutally paraphrasing the story.
Did you ever think to yourself, what happens if I'm discovered that this is just an act?
What's that?
When you were trying to get out of the Army and faking
all
this stuff.
Well, I think that it's kind of like partially, you know, they knew that I was acting crazy, but I was crazy to do that in the first. It was kind of like that, you know. It was like,
right. If you could do this so well, who wants you around
exactly.
Anyways?
Exactly. It was like Kafka meets Catch-22 or something.
Comedian Richard Belzer is my guest. He's in New York for a New Year's Eve performance at the Felt Forum. We'll talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Comedian Richard Belzer is my guest. No, you were talking about the chaplain in the Army who lectured you about...
Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, who lectured you about Judaism. I think the very first time I saw you perform was on Saturday Night Live, and you were doing your impression of Bob Dylan in, like, a retirement center, singing in a Yiddish accent.
Right, well, the 86-year-old Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Now, I hate to ask questions like,
sure,
how did that idea come to you? But really, how did that idea come to you?
Well, when I was a kid, I hate to say that Bob is that much older than me, but, well, when I was a kid. When I was a teenager, and we started first getting into Bob Dylan, and we found out his real name is Zimmerman, and he's a Jew from Minnesota, and this was like a revelation to have a hero that's a Jew. So I said, if his name is Zimmerman, he must have had a bar mitzvah. So I fantasized what Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah must have been like, you know. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech olam. And then when then he gets older, you know. Oi, oi, once upon a time, you dressed so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People called Shady Bear Doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they was all kidding you. And so on.
Oh, who spoke Yiddish in your family?
Actually, I just got back into Yiddish music. I've discovered these things. Everyone in my family spoke Yiddish, but I resent the fact that they didn't teach me. They didn't teach my brother or my cousins. My parents would talk in Yiddish. My grandparents would talk in Yiddish. And there's a comedian who does a routine. I can't think of who it is, but where it's true, if I may borrow the routine without crediting the person. And that is that Jewish families had the habit, the adults would tell a joke. They'd be telling a joke in English, and then a kid would walk in the room, and then they do the punchline in Yiddish. They'd say, so the guy walks up to the maid, he opens the door, he sees that she has no clothes on, and then a kid walks in the room, and he goes, Achal v'shinne v'chel v'cha! And you don't know what the punch... It was the most frustrating thing I've ever... I still resent my uncles to this day for doing that to me. And I wish I could remember the comedian that did that. Maybe it was Robert Klein, but... That's not my routine, but it's a true story.
You know, since it was the older people in your family who spoke Yiddish, did you think that when you grew up, you'd automatically know the language?
That's funny, because I have a theory that everyone, when they get old, no matter what religion they are, they have a Jewish accent. Even Irish people, they get to be past 65. I want to go to the store now, because I'm in the store? Good, because I can't. Hello? You know, everyone, Italians, everybody, they, for some reason, they get a Jewish accent. Don't ask me why.
Oh, gosh. earlier in your career, you were the comic that used to warm up the audiences for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I started doing that the first few shows, actually.
I didn't realize I'd even have a warm-up comic there. What kind of stuff did you have to do?
Well, it was kind of thrilling in those days to be a part of that because, you know, regardless of what anyone says, a lot of people didn't know how this was going to be accepted. This was like giving the kids the key to the store to have all these, in quotes, anti-establishment people have a TV show on a network. And so they asked me to do some sketches and do the warm-ups. I just kind of did what I did in nightclubs. I talked to the audience. I did some of my material, but I tried to improvise and ad-lib as much as I could, asking people where they're from. And it was fascinating doing that in a television studio, not a nightclub. So it was an interesting situation to be in.
I know that in... 84, I think it was, you were diagnosed as having cancer, and you're over that through surgery.
Oh, oh my God.
You said in a magazine article that in a way that was a blessing in disguise. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that when you feel the breeze from the wings of death, as I did, the more you feel how mortal you are. All the near-death cliches are true. It does change your life. You do look at things differently. You do value... people and events more, and I don't mean to be corny, but it's very true, and I think that I reordered my life as a result of that situation, and I don't recommend you go out and get cancer by any stretch of the imagination, but it's certainly not a totally negative situation. I mean, I was it's kind of hard to talk about. I was devastated by it, but it was also a very revelatory epiphany for me, if I may be Joycean for a second.
Do you think it changed your work as a comedian at all?
People say it has, but I feel I still have the same point of view. I have a very cynical point of view in terms of the world situation, and I think that comes through. I may seem less bitter now on stage, which is, I guess, in quotes, more commercial. But I'll let other people theorize about that.
My guest is comedian Richard Belzer. Now, I know you've just finished shooting a couple of movies
Yes.
that you're co-starring in.
Yes.
One is called Freeway, and in that you play a radio psychologist, someone who takes questions from listeners. And
you're on the air.
Yeah, right.
What's your problem?
Now, did you understudy someone for that?
Well, I did do some... I've done a lot of radio in my day.
But not as a psychologist.
No, not as a psychologist. The character is a Dr. David Lazarus. He's a psychiatrist who was a forensic psychiatrist in New York, and he moves to L.A. because he wants to get away from solving crimes in New York. What I did was I listened to a lot of people, and then I went to the studio. Do you know who Dr. Toni Grant is?
She's in Los Angeles?
Yeah, she's out of L.A. She's on nationally, but she's out of L.A. And I went and...
I haven't heard it. What does she do?
She's kind of like a hipper, younger Dr. Ruth without an accent.
Uh-huh.
That's the first time I describe her that way, but that's exactly what she is. She's a very lovely woman, very bright, and very sweet with the callers, but sometimes she can be real tough. And she gets a lot of interesting people calling her up from all over the country with different problems. Like, I found out my husband's bisexual. Should I be worried about AIDS? I love this fat woman, and every time she loses weight, I get sexually excited when she puts weight. You know, questions that you could never write. Amazing questions. A guy who masturbated in a laundromat. And that's a call they screened. They didn't even take that. But my thing was, I watched the guy. There was a guy who screens her calls. He has a little computer terminal in front of him. And he says, "Hello, Dr. Toni Grant, what's your name? How old are you? Where are you calling from? What's your problem? What do you want to talk to the doctor about?" And if it's acceptable to their format, then he types in the question, and then she takes it on her end. So it's fascinating. And it's sad in a way. But then there's a solution to it, because there's a lot of people that need somebody to talk to. And I mean, a lot of people make fun of call-in shows, but when someone is sensitive on the other end, like Toni Grant, then it really serves a function. I know it's instant analysis and pop psychology, but people in this country, a lot of people need someone to talk to. It's a huge problem.
So you're playing a sympathetic character in this movie?
Well, it's interesting because I get to be sympathetic and I also get to be cynical. I have asides to my assistant and I get sarcastic a little bit, but there's some underlying thing in my character that shows that he's really a caring person, even though he has a cynical veneer.
You're used to performing mostly your own material in stand-up,
right.
And now you're getting more into movies.
Right.
Do you ever have trouble performing somebody else's idea of funny?
That's a very good question. Fortunately, in these two films, both parts were written for me. So I've had the luxury of having characters that were based on my persona, or, you know, to a degree. I mean, the psychiatrist is not exactly who I am. But the director is a friend of mine and knew me and wrote me into the script. So I've been very lucky in these last two films, because I've been allowed to improvise certain material and certain things that I couldn't say. I hate to be a method actor, but some things you can't say. And I was very lucky. These guys were very acceptable to my notes. Sometimes we disagree, but, you know, usually they were right. So.
Now, you said that the films were written for your persona. Now, I don't think of you as a persona comic. Do you think of yourself as having a stage persona that's very different from who you are?
Not really. I mean, the older I get, I hate to say it, the older I get. I guess the older I get, the more I am like the person I am on stage. So the two are meeting. My offstage personality and my onstage personality are kind of converging. When I was younger, or years ago, I was much more, cynical and bitter on stage. And it carried over offstage, whereas now I think there's a nice balance. Did that make sense, that last?
Yeah. Okay. do you ever, you know, one of the problems nowadays is that special interests are so fragmented, and there's only a fairly narrow number of things that everybody knows in common, like the records everybody knows or the books everybody's read. Do you ever want to say something in one of your routines that you know you can't say because only like three people are going to get the joke?
Well, that's one of my jobs. I like to talk about esoteric things. I mean, not 90% of my act, but there are a lot of things in my act over the years that have been things that I've seen or read that is not open to the general public, or literary references, or things about science, or things about all different kinds of subjects that I feel compelled to talk about. And without being patronizing, sometimes I think I can educate the audience. And if I mention something that they never heard of, a literary reference or a line from a play or a new scientific discovery, then maybe they'll go and find out about it. So I'm not inhibited. I know a lot of comedians try to be as broad-based and as commercial and as accessible as possible and as least offensive as they can be. And for good or ill, I never subscribe to that theory.
Are you in stand-up for the long haul, or would you eventually like to get out of it and just go into acting?
You know, James Cagney, somebody once asked James Cagney what he would like to be remembered as, and he said a hoofer, because he was a dancer, and obviously he's one of the greatest actors in the history of film. I like to be remembered as a stand-up comic, or thought of as a stand-up comic, even though I'm very interested in acting in films and doing radio and records and some music things, but I'm basically a stand-up comedian, and proud of it.
Good.
Because there's a lot of people demean the occupation, but I think... And particularly in times like these, the comedy really serves a valuable function.
Why now more than any other time?
Because I think we're in... Reagan has put a false veneer on this country that we're going to wake up from like a bad dream. And it's going to be very... We're in for some very rough times in this country, economically, racially, politically, militarily. And I think that the multitude of comedians will serve their function well, the way films did in the 30s during the Depression. I think comedy will fill that void of uncertainty and fear.
Are you watching all the candidates now to see who's going to get elected and who you'll end up doing impressions of once they get into office?
Well, I'm afraid that George Bush is going to run this country into the ground. I'm watching it very closely, and I'm afraid that that George Bush is going to be our next president, as much as I hate to say that, because Americans are very insecure and very lazy, and they know his name. They know he's had this job, something called the vice president, so he must know something about it. That's why Reagan, you know, Reagan is like the father, the kind of dumb father figure who never spanks his kids that we kind of like and apologize for and are not really afraid of, even though he's incompetent.
You follow the news very closely for your comedy.
Yeah. Well, I used to be a newspaper reporter, so I follow the news, and it just winds up that I use it in my act, but I'm obsessed with the news. I would be anyway. I'd probably be a newspaper reporter if I wasn't a comedian.
Well, Richard Belzer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you a very happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
My guest has been comic Richard Belzer. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. He's in New York for a performance New Year's Eve at the Felt Forum. He has a starring role in the forthcoming films The Wrong Guys and Freeway. And in July, he has a new book out titled How to Be a Stand-Up Comic. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.